Okay, good evening, everyone. Broadcasting live, October 11th, 2015. We have another Dhammapada, so we might as well keep going with these. Although we could do Dhammapada like every other day and do something else, do the quotes.
Our quote is also from the Dhammapada.
Oh. Well, then we better stick to the order then, right? We have a long quote today. Test. Hello and welcome back to our study of the Dhammapada. Today we continue on with verse number 33. Start that again. Hi and welcome back to our study of the Dhammapada. Today we continue on with verse number 83. Which reads as follows. Sabbata ve sapurisa chajanti nakama kama lapayanti santo sukena wa putha atava dukena na uchavachang pandita dasayanti. Which means sabbata ve sapurisa chajanti sapurisa. Good people are always are everywhere. In every instance, on every occasion, renouncing, giving up. Nakama kama lapayanti santo. They don't mutter or blather or chatter as though they were. Nakama kama santo, as though they were enamored by sensuality, in love with love, or lusting after lustful things, desirous of the desirables. Sukena putta atava dukena, when touched by either happiness or suffering, na uchava chang pandita dasayanti, they don't exhibit, the wise don't exhibit highs or lows. So ordinary people, when touched by sukha or dukkha, happiness or suffering, they are affected. They are elated. They rejoice about their good fortune. They become somehow dependent on it. They step into it and they come to expect it. And when touched by suffering, then they lament and bemoan their state. But Asapurisa is ever chajanti, is ever renouncing, letting go. So that's the verse. It's in regards to a story about, it says 500 monks and 500 beggars. So in the time of the Buddha, after the Buddha was recently enlightened, he was staying in Vairanja. He lived there for the rains. He had been invited to stay in Vairanja. If you read the beginning of the Vinaya, Tena ko panasamayena buddho bhagava Vairanjayang viharati. The Buddha was dwelling in Vairanja. And this Brahmin invited him to stay there and then forgot about him. And so the Buddha and his 500 monks dwelt in great hardship. And they only were able to survive because of some horse traders who gave them horse food, gave them oats, basically, well, something like oats, some kind of grain. and they were able to live off this grain. But it was great hardship, so they went on alms, but I guess didn't get much. And this Brahmin who invited them to this area where they weren't able to get alms totally forgot about them until the end of the rains. But it says here that there were a bunch of beggars living with them. By the kindness of the monks, 500 eaters of refuse lived within the monastery enclosure. Or it doesn't even say that, but what it does say is that I get the point is these beggars were before, so they weren't living, I was wrong, they weren't living with the Buddha at Vairanja. But in Vairanja, the monks, these 500 monks, were all at least Sotapanna, maybe all arahants. And they were all living with the Buddha and they were content with their poor fare. They were at peace, even in great hardship. Later on, they came to great wealth and prosperity, not wealth in terms of money, but they were very well cared for. They moved to Sawati and they lived there. But they were still the same, they were still at peace. So whether they lived in hardship or whether they lived in great comfort, they were the same. And then you had these 500 beggars who appeared after there was great wealth, and because of their own hardship, decided that they would hang out at the monastery. And so, out of the kind, through the kindness of the monks, these 500 beggars sort of lived off the leftover food, because everyone was always bringing food to the monks and coming to hear the monks teach and supporting the monks in different ways, and so there was lots of leftovers, and so these beggars would come. And it says they would eat the choice food left over by the monks and then lie down and sleep. And then when they got up from their sleep, they would be full of energy and they would go and wrestle. They would shout and jump and wrestle and play, misbehave both within and without the monastery. They did nothing but misbehave. And so the monks were discussing this, and they noted the difference, because ostensibly a part of the problem for these beggars was the opulence, right? Once they got great food, they got strength and energy, and they just started acting rambunctious. Whereas the monks, whether they were in hardship or in opulence or affluence, were unchanged. And so the Buddha, for that reason, he told a Jataka story about horses, which is actually quite interesting, because it points out that even, it's a story about some donkeys and horses, and these thoroughbred horses were fed, it was an accident or something, they were fed wine of some sort or some kind of alcohol and were unaffected by it. But these donkeys who were hanging out with the thoroughbred horses drank the same wine and started braying and carrying on. The point being that alcohol, even though we rail against it as being a terrible, terrible thing, It has the power to do is remove your inhibitions. So if you don't have any harmful intentions in your mind, it doesn't actually hurt you. Unfortunately, that for most of us, like, that includes delusion, it includes ego, and so on. So if you have none of that, then you're fine. But anyway, he makes the point that this is the difference between people. For an ordinary person, it's actually an interesting point, because for ordinary people, it's sometimes the other way around. Sometimes when things are fine, people can be quite moral and ethical, right? when you don't need to steal, when you don't need to kill, when there's no adversity, when there's no danger. But when the going gets tough, many people will abandon their ethics, abandon their goodness, their generosity. And for other people, it's the other way around. In hardship, they are forced to behave themselves. They have to act in such a way that other people respect them and so on. But when things are good, they get lazy, right? Or for monastics, this is very much the case. When things are rough, you know, you're forced to be mindful because there's lots of physical pain and physical discomfort and hunger and thirst and heat and cold that you can't escape. But when you have the pleasure and the luxury, then it's very easy to get lazy. It's very easy to become indulgent and so on. It's actually quite an impressive thing, impressive feat, that these monks, having been in such hardship, going to such opulence and not being affected by it. But the point still stands that it works both ways, and it seems more to be about change than anything. That after a while you become sort of stable in your situation. And if things don't change, you become you may become complacent, thinking that everything is okay. But then when things change, you see that you see what you couldn't see because of the stability. Part of it points out the nature of impermanence, or the importance of impermanence, the harm, the danger of change to one's psyche. That and also the usefulness of impermanence for that very reason. When things change, you're able to better see your defilement when you have the rug pulled out from under you, right? When everything's going stable, whether it's difficult, if it's difficult, you plod along. If it's good, then you feel calm and at peace. But when things change, you can be quite upset. A person who is living in opulence, if they fall into hardship, would have a very hard time coping mentally with it. So it goes both ways, and this is continuing this theme. In this verse of the, we've seen this recently quite a bit. We talk about how wise people, touched by either happiness or unhappiness, happiness or suffering, show no change. Na uccha vaccha dasayanti. Uccha means a high, and avaccha means a low. So they experience no highs or lows. Which is interesting. People often think of that as being a terribly dull and uninteresting state. It's certainly not something to be strived for. The highs and the lows are the spice of life, they would say, or it gives life meaning, I guess. It gives meaning to your happiness. But it's actually quite the opposite. We find people who are stuck on happiness and suffering, that these are the ones who are like zombies. They can be very depressed and colorless in their constant aversion to suffering, or in their constant obsession with happiness. A zombie is someone who is constantly seeking out pleasure. It's by seeking out pleasure that you become this zombie that consumes and consumes. Or you're a zombie working just to survive in great hardship, just to cope with suffering. A person who has had great loss becomes a zombie. A person who exhibits neither highs or lows is actually quite at peace, has quite a calm and uplifted mind, a light mind, a mind that is flexible, a mind that is kind and compassionate, because they don't have they aren't caught up in their own emotions, so they're able to approach life with great zest and vigor and clarity and goodness as well. So their intentions to help others and that kind of thing are pronounced. Their happiness and their peace are much pronounced. So they're anything but a zombie. The zombie is the one who is caught up in likes and dislikes. And they become tired and they get into this trance-like state, zombie-like state of consuming pleasure and coping with suffering. It's a warning for all of us not to become complacent. It's easy to think that you're moral and ethical. If you don't look closely, it's easy to think, well, I'm not a bad person, I'm living fine. But so much of that is often dependent on our pleasure, and when you start to meditate, you start to see, ah, yes, actually, I'm quite intoxicated by this pleasure. And many of the things that I thought were harmless are actually building me up to take a fall. Because when I'm not able to indulge in sensual pleasures anymore, I'm going to get angry and upset and frustrated. It's what leads us to fight and quarrel and manipulate others, our indulgence in sensuality. It's really the crux of it. Our reactions to pleasant experiences and our reactions to unpleasant experiences. This about sums up all of the problems that we have, or the problems of the mind that we're working to overcome. We have these two. There's a third one that's not really explicitly mentioned here, and that's delusion. We consider these to be the three evils in the mind, the three things that lead us to suffer. But they're not equal. You know, happiness and unhappiness lead to greed and anger, liking and disliking. Our reactions to these things, these are, you could say, the surface problem. But the underlying problem, the third one is the underlying problem. Our delusion is how we approach these things. You know, the reason we get angry about unpleasant things, the reason we become attached to pleasant things, is because of our delusion, because of our ignorance, our perception that this one's going to make me happy, this one's something that the way to be happy is to avoid it. If I chase after this one, I'll be happy. If I push this one away, I'll also be happy. Not realizing that the more we push this one away, the more unhappy we'll become. The more we cling to this one, the more needy we will become, and so the more unhappy we will become. And shameful we'll become. You know, if you ask yourself, who would you rather have as a friend? Who would you rather associate with? Someone who wants a lot, or someone who doesn't have, who has great wanting, or someone who has little wanting? Who has great desires, strong desires, or someone who has simple desires, or is free from desire? Right? I don't know. Some people might say they like people who have great desires, but if you think about it, when people have great desires, then they end up wanting a lot from you. Friends who have great desires can be great burdens. Friends who are hard to please. Or friends who have great, people who have great aversion to suffering. So this is the sort of situation we have here, where part of the implication here is that these guys are acting improper, or acting in an unsuitable way. I mean, having eaten this food that was meant for the monks, and sort of living in close quarters with these spiritual people, they're acting like ordinary individuals. You get that a lot in monasteries when they get big in Thailand. We'd see this a lot, where the workers in the monasteries, not so very moral. Someone, I don't know, I was talking to one of the workers about cockroaches, and she I think she pulled out a can of cockroach spray and was trying to hand it to me. And yeah, I remember going. We went on this parade once. The monks. We were up in this boat. They had us up on this float with a boat. It was like a boat, and people were putting food in the boat. It was a means of supporting. I don't know actually what it was, what the food was going to be for, but it was a parade with monks, which was kind of nice. But then the board of directors for the monastery was surrounding it and going on with us, and then they pulled out alcohol and started drinking whiskey. Well, you know, all around us, they were holding on to the edges of the boat and riding the float. And it's a shame, really, that sort of thing, that living so close to such goodness and such spiritual teachings, that they don't bother to put them into practice. And part of it is this problem of having things too good. When things are good, people may tend to misbehave. It's part of the reason why monks are encouraged to go off into the forest and live in simple accommodations, to live some more or less in hardship, because it can keep you honest. It forces you to be mindful. In terms of the monastic life, hardship is quite often important for spiritual development, because it's very easy to get lazy, as we can see here. Anyway, so a simple teaching. The verse itself has some interesting points. The idea that what makes a good person is their practice of renunciation everywhere, whether they're happy or unhappy. And they never blather on. Lapayanti, it's an interesting word. They chatter. The implication is that people who are intoxicated with sensuality will blather on about it. Something we should catch ourselves in, talking about food or clothing or music or art or this kind of thing. But one who is wise, when touched by either happiness or by sorrow, is at peace, is content. Their happiness, their peace, their contentment is not dependent. It's anamisa sukha, is a happiness that is not based on an object. It doesn't require this or that. It isn't affected. It isn't disturbed. It isn't disturbed, and it isn't dependent on external senses, external experiences or phenomena. This is why meditation is so important. It's important to understand change and to become familiar with change and to see that change is a part of life, so that changes don't affect us, so that our happiness can be, our peace of mind can be undisturbed by change. Anyway, so that's the teaching of this Dhammapada verse. That's all for now. Thank you for tuning in. Keep practicing and be well. So, do you have any questions?
I'm sure we do, Bhante. Sorry, I got caught up in the story and didn't check the questions. Hello, Bhante. There aren't any teachers or retreats close to where I live. I'm doing 3 hours a day of meditation. I know you said that meditation can be risky if done intensively and without a teacher, but I'm thinking I can do more as time goes by and my mind becomes stronger. I'm thinking about building my practice up to 8 hours a day over the years. Is this a good approach?
If your practice is proper, that the reason for having a teacher is to keep you on the right path. I mean, sure, you can say you're practicing 8 hours, but what exactly are you doing for 8 hours? I mean, theoretically, if you're using my booklet, I would think you're practicing as I deem to be correct, but there are nuances and there are subtleties to it that are easy to miss, you know, very, very easy to miss without a teacher. So definitely with 8 hours, doing 8 hours a day, you'd want some contact with a teacher, I would think. Unless you're a special individual, which, you know, most people do think they're a bit special, so to be careful of that as well.
Just in case you weren't aware, if you click on the Meet button, Bhante actually has one-on-one reporting time with meditators from this group, and there are several slots left. So, what do you think of the people of the hardcore Dharma movement, like Daniel Ingram, who says that an arahant can still have lust and aversion to certain states?
I've heard that he's since recanted his claim to be an arahant, so I mean, I don't think about them that much, so again, it's one of these situations where it's not something I think about, and I don't really want to comment on other groups. Sorry.
I feel that taste is very close to feeling, so when I'm tasting something, I say feeling, feeling. Is that right practice?
No. There are different scents. I mean, for most of us, there are different scents. Taste is a taste, feeling is a feeling.
Another question on the heart in the left-hand column of the meditator list, and that is, when people are showing that they're sending metta after their meditation, you just click on your check and it'll turn into a heart. Or if you're on the Android app, you just long click the start button and it'll turn it into a heart by your name. Is the mind strength developed by samatha different compared to one developed by vipassana?
Yeah, I mean, vipassana ultimately leads to nibbana, so it is, that's a stable strength of mind, permanent, you could say. Whereas with samatha, it's impermanent. Oh, got to turn Robin up. I wonder, you know, there should be a way to pipe you into this mic as well. I'll have to figure that out.
I found out what happened yesterday when my mic sounded really terrible. It was actually unplugged. I didn't realize someone in my family had unplugged it. So I was just going through the webcam mic. So sorry about that. I know it kind of messed up the audio yesterday. Is the point to fully accept all experiences without judgment?
The point is to become free from suffering, but eventually you get to a state where you fully accept all experiences without judgment. And, you know, it's poor wording, and I'm not comfortable with the word accept, because, or without judgment, because they're vague words in English. So if you accept something, that means can be taken to mean that you consider it to be proper. You consider it to be acceptable, right? And if you have no judgment, that means also that you don't see that which is harmful as being harmful. You don't judge that which is harmful as being harmful. You see, it can mean that. So you might say, experience experiences as they are, without wrong judgment. So when you experience something as impermanent, then that thing is actually something to be discarded, not to be accepted. So once you're fully equanimous towards things, you see them as they are, you don't get upset or elated by them, but you end up rejecting them as useless. You don't accept them and say, well, this is how I want to live my whole, this is what I want to happen in the future, or this is fine with me in the future. You actually give them up and discard them. So there's that sense of discarding the those things that are impermanent, unsatisfying, and uncontrollable. So I don't like to say it's accept things or to not judge them, because to some extent there is a judgment that goes on. The judgment is, these are useless, these are suffering, these are without benefit to me, and throwing them out, abandoning them.
During meditation, I am having recollections of moments from my life that I have not thought about in many years, forgotten moments and places from childhood. Is this progress or just distraction?
It's a sign of progress. That in and of itself isn't progress, but it's a sign that you have stronger concentration than before, or you have a clearer mind than before, and so these things are coming up. But it still can be a distraction, so you have to note it as thinking, or if you have feelings about it, liking or disliking or worry or fear or so on, you have to acknowledge it.
You've spoken about the relative wholesomeness of various occupations. Is working in aged care to be considered wholesome?
Yep. I would say mostly. I mean, look, if you're working with old people and you're mean to them, that's not wholesome. If you're working with old people and you're caring for them and you're kind to them and you're humble and you're servile, I guess, is a word maybe people don't want to hear, but to some extent, you know, you're working for them to like a being a tool for them without any ego or attachment or anger or you know, oppression, because sometimes in those situations old people are treated as you know, prisoners, and you're the jailer, so you're in charge, kind of thing. So, you know, can be actually quite unwholesome. Part of it is the issue of medication. My grandmother lived in an old age home, and they just medicated her almost to death. You know, when we finally found out, I wasn't involved with the decision making, but she was put in this old age home, which in and of itself was probably a mistake. But then they just neglected her, and by the time we found out, she was addicted to these drugs, and she couldn't go off them without being in terrible, terrible pain. So I'm not convinced that old age homes are a good thing. It'd be nicer if old people were taken care of by their families, but in cases where it's necessary for them to find someone to take care of them, if you have good intentions, you know, it can be a great thing. It's a great opportunity to do a good deed. Even if you're working in the restaurant industry, if you're serving people food and you're humble and servile, I think. I mean, I don't know a better word, but something like that, in the sense of consider yourself working for them and having no ego or anything, then it can be quite wholesome as well, because you're bringing and you're helping people. You're doing a service for people. These kind of things can be wholesome. If you sell things that are useful for people and you sell them at good prices, you know, good prices for people and not cheating anyone, that can be wholesome. But definitely looking after people, old people, young people, any type of person, if you're helping them out, seems like quite a wholesome job to me. Can also require great patience. That's a good aspect of it.
While doing metta towards my enemies, I experience sort of delight in that they receive the consequences of their karma. How can I avoid that?
Well, you don't have to avoid it. You have to acknowledge it. That's where vipassana is more useful. If you're practicing metta, you would go back to someone you loved and slowly try to send metta to them. You could avoid it. You can avoid it by going back to a neutral person or a person you love and focusing on them first and then slowly going back to the person who you don't like. But in Vipassana, it's more important that you practice Vipassana to try and let go of those feelings by saying liking, or the underlying anger or hatred you have towards them.
Is there an online library of Buddhist texts?
Oh, probably. We have one that I kind of copied from someone else. It's on static.sirimangalo.org/PDF. There's a page with a whole bunch of PDFs, but most of them are not that interesting to me. I just copied them over there. There's some of them are probably interesting.
Bhante, can you give an example of the element of cohesion?
You don't experience cohesion, apparently. But cohesion is what keeps things together. It's the aspect of physical reality that keeps things together. So like glue or, static, actually. Static attraction.
If I meditate after the nightly YouTube talks, will my question mark symbol be green the next night?
No, it's just taking you from the list here, which I think is 2 or 3 hours. The list below, if you're on this list, then you're green. If you're not on this list, then you're orange. It doesn't really matter. If you're orange, we still answer your questions, but if we click on your username and don't see that you've done any meditation in your meditation log, then we might say, this is not a meditator. Now don't worry if you're yellow sometimes, orange sometimes. It's the psychology of the internet, right? You can really play with people's minds. You have to acknowledge that feeling. If you feel guilty or bad or upset because you're not green, then you should acknowledge that. Good practice.
Somewhere in here, and I had spotted it earlier, was an interesting question. If you go somewhere and practice meditation locally, but you can't necessarily log in, should you log that in afterwards to show that you meditated? I mean, you could potentially spend, like you have on Saturdays, you now have a day of meditation. So someone could be meditating for maybe 6 hours, but maybe it's not necessarily convenient to log in during a live event.
I didn't want to make too much out of the logs because, for reasons like that, because, I don't log all my meditation, but I wouldn't worry about it. There's no reason to do that. We're not giving out awards for the amount of meditation you've done. For that reason, we haven't paid too much attention to it. On the other hand, we would like to eventually get to the point where we have apps for people's phones, both Android and iOS, so that you could log it, and that would be nice because then we'd be able to keep track of your meditation. We'd have a sense, here's another person meditating. It's a support for our community, because when we see that you're on the list, then it's another person to show that we're a large group and that we're not meditating alone, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I use the Android app frequently, and I've done it a couple times at live events, but you do have to be careful to go into the settings and turn the tone off, because definitely don't want to disturb other people with the bird sound or something like that. Should we be careful to think that we experience cessation?
I don't understand. Not to think? Careful about such thoughts.
careful about assuming that we experience sensation, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. It's easy to overestimate your experiences. You know, my teacher said, look and see how much greed, anger, and delusion you have. If you have less, then, well, you're doing well. If you have more, well, but it should be less over time.
As an amateur musician, it's not clear for me how creating music can be thought of as bringing suffering. Could you please explain?
It's something you like, you know, it's an addiction. It stimulates the brain. And if you look at the science of it, stimulating the brain is a path of diminishing returns. So you end up needing more as time goes on to get the same pleasure. And so that's why we try to listen to different types of music, because we try to stimulate the brain in a new way. And so that we can get the same pleasure, but it's building up these pathways, it's strengthening the pathways of desire and the pathways of sense gratification. And it's the same reason why drugs cause us suffering in the end, because you can never get enough. You will always wind up in a place where you feel bored or you feel the need. As human beings, we have the luxury of getting what we want, but put a person who likes making music in a position where they're unable to make music and they'll be unhappy. You know, we don't get that so much because we are, for the most part, able to do what we want. But tell a musician that they have to work a 9-to-5 job, give up their music, you know, they'll be unhappy. It's a very minor thing. I mean, music isn't going to send you to hell or anything, but it does make you stressed out when you can't get it, like anything else. And so you won't see it, but there'll be more subtle manifestations of that, where you'll feel bored, and you could, if you were really in tune with your mind, or someone who was really in tune with their mind, could see that that was a cause of addiction to music. But it's a very small thing. It's not like music is really, really bad. But like anything, it's certainly not the way to find freedom from suffering.
Could you explain how to send metta after meditating? Do you recommend doing this after every session?
Yeah, I did a video for kids on that. You should look at that video. First, I would send it to yourself. May I be happy, and then the people in the room. This is how I do it, you know, it's one of the ways. It's more comfortable for me. I used to do it based on people I love, and then people neutral, and then people who I don't know, and so on. But that's too, I don't know, it's too messy for me. I always think about the people in the room next to me, and then in the building, and then in, you know, go on gradually to the town, the city, or the neighborhood, the city, the country, then the world. And that seems to work a lot better. Simple.
It's probably better as you're becoming more equanimous too, toward, you know, not necessarily putting people in categories of those I love and those I dislike and all.
Yeah.
What would be the point of recording video while one meditates?
I don't know. What would be the point?
The question is regarding the other day when we were meditating online together. We were meditating online together.
Oh, that wasn't record. I mean, yeah, it was just the point wasn't to record. The point was to broadcast.
I think you had a busy day and you were still during your meditation session when the broadcast started, so you finished it out.
Yeah, I mean, the point was to broadcast meditation. I mean, that's nice, actually, to do live meditation sittings where you can see each other meditating. I did that in Sri Lanka for a while when Google Hangouts came out new. I would do a non-on-air hangout and invite people in my circles to meditate. And so we'd see each other meditating, up to 10 people.
So back to the music, we're getting ready to move to an office with an open floor plan, and they're giving us all this information on how to get along with people when there's 100 people in one room, basically.
Mm.
And one of the things is because it's distracting and so forth, they kind of recommend that you wear headphones or earbuds and listen to some music to keep you calm.
Mm.
Probably not going to do that.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to take an extreme case as far as listening to music goes, a lot of the young kids who are listen to their music all the time tend to be quite unpleasant towards their parents. It's not totally because of the music, but it's definitely a part of it. I've seen it where they always got these earphones, and when you tell them to take it out, then they sit there and they bounce their knee and they're uncomfortable, you know. It's an addiction. It's part of the addiction. It's not huge, but it can become quite a big part of one's addiction framework, right? We have all these different means as humans that we can, all the different things that can make us happy, food, sex, music, drugs, alcohol, television, games, you know? And we go from one to the other and we're very good at it, you know? We're able to live a life of such pleasure. Ignoring the fact that there are other people screaming in pain, you know, dying horrible deaths and being tortured and raped and burned alive and this and that, and that all could happen to us at any moment, right? Well, you know, it could happen to us. We could get run over by a car. There was this woman who was run over by a car and then dragged screaming under the car for blocks. It was in Toronto many years ago. And the old woman who ran her over had never found out about it. And they never told the woman who was driving the car. Hopefully they revoked her license, I don't know, but
it's terrible.
Yeah, I mean, it can happen to you. And listening to music isn't going to help you then.
No.
In fact, the point is that it makes you more susceptible to pain, more susceptible to discomfort. Okay, enough. That's all for tonight. Thank you all for tuning in. Thanks, Robin, for taking part. And so tomorrow we have no Robin, so we need volunteers for tomorrow. I think Stefano was saying he could join us, or if there's anybody else who would like to join the hangout, give me a ring, let me know. Monday and Tuesday it will be just me.
Thank you, Bhante.
Thank you. Good night, everyone.
Good night.